This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 35 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. Mike, welcome to the show. I'm kind of excited. We have kind of a different topic for our listeners today.
We most certainly do, Zachary. We should probably preface this by saying to our listeners that we are broadcasting from the 10th circle of hell.
Well, Mike, I don't hear any echoes, so I'm thinking they've got a pretty good acoustic tiling around those circles of hell. What do you think?
Outstanding acoustics. Only the best in the 10th circle of hell.
Naturally. But seriously, Mike, I was actually reading Dante's Inferno the other day, and it's something I haven't read in a long time. I first read it when I was in high school, and it's something I go back to periodically in life. And it occurred to me as I was reading the very first stanza of this poem, The Divine Comedy, that that it would make a pretty interesting topic for Metatrex. And I'll read the line that it got me thinking about this, and we can use that as a branching off point to our discussion about how this relates to Star Trek and the characters in Star Trek. But here's the line that really spawned the idea for me. Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood. And it just got me thinking about all the different characters in Star Trek that have gone astray in one way or another from the path that they're supposed to be on, whether it's their destiny or the path that they're supposed to be on as being part of Starfleet and part of the Federation and being together with a crew of their respective starships or space stations. And oftentimes when you're struggling like that, when you've fallen off the path you're supposed to be on, when you're in a dark place, when you feel like you're alone, when you've lost your way, you need someone to drag you out of that. And you can see that happen many times inside the Star Trek universe. And it got me thinking, you know, this is very much like what you see in The Divine Comedy. Dante, the author of the Divine Comedy, feels like he's gone astray in life. And in the course of The Divine Comedy, there are figures that come to him in the form of the poet Virgil and his former romantic interest, but the character of Beatrice, who is for him the symbol of divine love. Those characters really help to take him on a journey that leads him out of his dark place and in and back onto the road that he's supposed to be on. And all of these stories that you see in Star Trek of characters going astray and being led back onto the path they're supposed to be on, you can trace the seeds of those in this this work, The Divine Comedy by Dante.
Zachary, I remember reading Divine Comedy when I was an 11th grade English lit student, and the thing that struck me about it then and still strikes me now is the fact that it's such a perfect allegory for what oftentimes we go through in life. We find ourselves in a place where we either by our own choices or sometimes by circumstances beyond our control, we find ourselves in a dark place. And it oftentimes takes the help of other people that we have in our lives to come and help pull us out of that place. And as we've talked about many times in the Star Trek universe, art oftentimes imitates life. And so our friends, these characters in the Star Trek universe, are no different than we are. They find themselves in difficult places, and it takes the help of others. And we didn't really talk about this one in the Turbo Lift, but one of the first examples that kind of comes to my mind, honestly, is the Doctor from Star Trek Voyager, in the episode Latent Image from season 5, the Doctor is forced to make a choice. Does he save Harry Kim or does he save Ensign Jital? And he makes the difficult choice to operate and save Harry Kim when he's injured. But that choice comes with consequences. Ensign Jital ends up dying. And of course, he has, in many respects, a breakdown of sorts. And the crew of Voyager, in particular Captain Janeway, makes the choice to wipe his program of those memory engrams so that he's not able to recall, and that protects his program from this loop that's caused because of the difficulty in wrestling with the choice. But in the end, the Doctor decides that he needs to live with it, so to speak, and work through it. And something that strikes me and has always touched me near the end of the episode, the Doctor's in the holodeck. Now, Captain Janeway's there with him to support him as he walks through all of that. In fact, she's ordered a 24-hour-a-day vigil of support in which she sat with him for 16 hours at this point when we come to the scene. She even says to him when he suggests that she leave and get some rest that she's there helping a friend. So the Doctor's there. He's wrestling with his programming. He's in a dark place. He's on a journey, and Janeway's there to guide him. She's his sounding board, listening, caring, supporting, guiding, whatever he needs. And while she's there, she's reading a book of poetry. Now, we don't know this until a little later when the Doctor reads from the book at the very end of the episode what that book is. But he reads this passage. He says, quote, "In that book, which is my memory, on the first page of the chapter, that is the day when I first met you, appear the words, here begins a new life," end quote. And as you know, Zachary, that's a paraphrased quote from Dante's La Vita Nuova, featuring the Beatrice character, which Catherine Janeway clearly and literally represents.
Well, you know, Mike, what I think I like about this connection with La Vita Nuova in this episode of Voyager is just that it sheds a little bit of light on why the Beatrice character plays so much of an important role in the Divine Comedy. I think if you don't have this backstory that Dante was in love with this character Beatrice and she becomes kind of a symbol of hope for him, it's a really romantic story Beatrice becomes the symbol of hope and divine love for him, and he describes it very romantically as beginning a new life, and you can see that in this quote from La Vita Nuova. And this is just, you know, somewhat analogous to the Doctor's experience here. The Doctor desperately needs someone who becomes a symbol of hope for him, who can help drag him out of the situation. Janeway becomes this Beatrice character within the context of this episode, and indeed even for the Voyager crew as a whole, insofar as the Voyager crew is lost on their journey in the Delta Quadrant and trying to get home. And so this reference to La Vita Nuova is just really rich symbolically on a lot of levels. I like the connection to the Inferno. I like the connection to the situation in this episode. I like the connection to Voyager's situation in the Delta Quadrant. And, if you don't have this backstory on Dante, the person, and his relationship with the character Beatrice and how she becomes the symbol of divine love, I think the role that she plays in the Divine Comedy as a whole is not as intelligible. So this is a really, symbolically rich, quote of La Vita Nuova on a lot of levels.
For sure, because his programming actually, in many respects, Zachary, is the character Virgil. I mean, the programming, the logic, the problem solving, the algorithms that are written in there really in many ways silently represent Virgil, and it can only take him so far. And so he needs the love and hope and friendship that Janeway provides to get him the rest of the way through his journey.
And I think that anyone who's been in a crisis can relate to this. You know, when you're in the middle of a crisis, everything seems chaotic. You can't find peace. Your whole life is thrown into an upheaval, and you need someone who can cut through all of that and speak to you on a personal level and calm your inner chaos. And Janeway is definitely doing this for the Doctor. And in fact, I think she does it for the entire Voyager crew in their 7-year journey.
For sure.
Well, even though we want to talk about characters in Star Trek who have gone astray, and we're going to talk about a bunch of different examples of different characters who've gone astray and had to be led back onto whatever the path they're supposed to be on is, it's easy to forget that there are some really obvious references to the Divine Comedy and to the Inferno right inside Star Trek. Shattered is the obvious one that comes to mind. If you remember, Shattered is the episode in which Voyager gets fragmented into different time periods, and Commander Chakotay has to take Captain Janeway on a journey out of her own time period, looking at these other time periods on Voyager. And of course, this is symbolic. You know, Voyager is about to become stranded in the Delta Quadrant. Captain Janeway is in the dark. She doesn't understand the situation going on around her. And Chakotay, to basically help her understand that he is who he says he is, that they have a future relationship, and he becomes her future first officer, to indicate that he knows more about her than he should, you know, from Captain Janeway's standpoint, he quotes a passage from her favorite book, you know, The Divine Comedy. And it's actually the same passage we read at the beginning of the show, the first stanza of The Inferno. It's a different translation than one we read. I happen to like the one we started out the podcast with a little better, but he says, in the middle of the journey of our life, I found myself astray in a dark wood where the straight road had been lost. And that's so symbolic in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, Voyager is about to get stranded in the Delta Quadrant, and you know, Janeway is lost in this situation. Voyager is going to be lost in the Delta in the Delta Quadrant, and here comes, you know, Commander Chakotay, a la Virgil, about to lead Janeway on a journey out of her own time period in a look into the future, a glimpse into Voyager's future time period. So it's interesting because Chakotay often plays that role for Janeway. You know, he is the you know, he grounds her experience. Insofar as other people lean on Janeway, I think Chakotay is the one that Janeway leans on for, and Tuvok to a lot of to some degree. But you know, over the years, we see that Janeway and Chakotay form this close relationship. Janeway leans on Chakotay, and Chakotay is in this case responsible for taking Janeway on a journey that will lead to better understanding and lead to, you know, being on the path of that Voyager is supposed to be on. Which, ironically, the path that Voyager is supposed to be on is the path of being lost, and I find that an interesting irony in this use of the Divine Comedy in this episode, Shattered.
Yeah, I think the only thing that it was missing, if memory serves, there were four time periods I think represented in Shattered. The only thing I think it was missing was it should have been nine. It should have been nine time periods. It should have been a journey taking her through the nine circles of Voyager.
Yeah, this is something we're not going to talk about very much, but Dante's use of numbers inside the Divine Comedy and inside the Inferno is very interesting. There's nine circles of hell, mm-hmm. and his use of the number three and the number nine is very intentional. It kind of has this Catholic biblical numerology bent to it, but it also hinges on Dante's experience with Beatrice, encountering Beatrice three times and being rejected three times. And this number becomes very significant to Dante. So three being an important number, nine being the square of that number, three times three. So there's nine circles of hell. And all of this the symbology of these numbers, you know, it definitely informs Dante's structural thinking about the Divine Comedy. So which circle of hell is Voyager in the Delta Quadrant? You know, they're lost, they're on a journey.
Well, I definitely think if there would have been nine periods that they would have covered. I think for them to call this particular episode the Nine Circles of Voyager, I think would have been better than Shattered. But you're absolutely right. The references to numerology, three being the number of the Trinity in theology. You have the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and so three is a very significant number in Catholic and, for that matter, Christian numerology. And of course, three times three is nine. So Dante's kind of playing on those symbols. Those
and nine is well known as a symbol of completion. The number of nine is a number of completion. Mm-hmm. So these numbers are very important. But you know, we mentioned which circle of hell Voyager would be in. I think we should point out that according to Tom Paris, life on Voyager in season seven of Voyager, you know, life on Voyager is more like paradise, right? It's the Paradiso. It's not the Inferno.
It didn't start out that way for him, though. So I think that in many ways symbolizes the completion of Tom Paris's journey.
You're saying there should have been nine seasons of Voyager? I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, there should have been nine seasons of Voyager. I completely agree with that. I could have watched two more seasons.
Yeah, likewise. Voyager is my favorite Star Trek show, so I could have dealt with two more seasons to complete the journey. Exactly.
Indeed. There are a few other direct references in the Star Trek universe to Dante's Inferno. Should we touch on those rather quickly?
The one that comes most obviously to mind is that in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, when Chekhov and Captain Terrell first enter the Botany Bay and they're looking around, they discover these old Earth artifacts. One of the books on Khan's bookshelf it's actually the Chiardi translation of the Divine Comedy, the translation we mentioned before. And, I never really knew what to make of this, frankly. I mean, the Botany Bay, they're certainly stranded on this, on SETI Alpha 5. So in that sense, they're sort of collectively lost or stranded on this planet. It's not like Khan ever gets redeemed in any meaningful way. So there's no real strong parallel with the Inferno, I think. But I think it's an interesting thing to note that this fairly evil character inside the Star Trek universe has symbolically, a possession of this copy of the Divine Comedy, which is, of course, the first portion of the Divine Comedy is hell. So I think it's an attempt for the writer to sort of symbolically place Khan somewhere inside this world of hell that's depicted in the Inferno.
Yeah, I think that was absolutely the intent, and point well taken.
So the other example I wanted to mention, Mike, is the Next Generation episode, Devil's Due. And inside that episode, if you remember, Data is doing a production of The Christmas Carol on a holodeck. Mm-hmm. And inside the set of that, there's a statue of Dante. And I didn't realize this. I had to look it up on the internet. It's something I never noticed. And without a doubt, the vast majority of listeners out there have not noticed that there's a statue of Dante inside this set. And I just I don't think it has a deep and meaningful connotation, except for the fact that this episode is titled Devil's Due, and the character of Ardra is styled as a devil-like figure. Mm-hmm. So, incorporating Dante into the episode in some way, when there's a depiction of the devil, kind of in irony quotes, inside this episode is a nice connection, but I don't think there's any deep and rich meaning to it other than that fairly superficial connection.
Yeah, it's not an obvious connection, and I didn't realize until we were talking about it in the Turbo Lift that statue was present in this episode. So I'm one of those folks who would have probably never caught that had you not mentioned it.
See, now every time you see this episode, that's the only thing you're going to notice.
I'm going to look for the statue. Dante. Yes.
Right. So you can see, the use of the Inferno and the Divine Comedy are kind of scattered throughout the Star Trek universe in various ways to various degrees. But clearly, this is something that's in the background of several writers who've worked on Star Trek. And the connection with Shattered and the connection with Latent Image is very explicit.
Yeah, and we definitely have quite a few examples that we're going to draw from where at least the theme and story of Dante's Inferno definitely have some direct influence on the stories inside the Star Trek universe.
Well, Mike, I don't often give book recommendations here on Metatrex. For me, talking about philosophy is vastly more about the importance and the significance of the philosophical issues that we talk about than giving people a reading list. Although once in a while, I'll drop a reference. Mm-hmm. It'd be great if you read this from Descartes or this from Kant or whatever. But realistically, for me, the Divine Comedy is one of those top five essential you have to read this book in life kind of book recommendations. So anyone who's listening, if you haven't read the Divine Comedy, I'm going to give one of my very few book recommendations on Metatrex. Go out and pick up the Divine Comedy. Start with the first part, the Inferno, and there's a translation that I like the best by a guy named John Chiardi, and by far that I think it's the most readable, most poetic, most informative version of the Divine Comedy that's out there, mainly because it not only tries to capture the original sort of verse quality to the Divine Comedy, but there are incredibly informative notes that explain the rich symbolism in the book. It's very easy to miss the richness of the book if you read it purely on a surface level. So make sure you pick up that particular translation. I think it's really the best. So go if you haven't read it, go out and pick up that book. Read it. You'll your life will be better for it in one way or another, I have no doubt. But for me, what I love about the Divine Comedy, Mike, is its ability to combine a number of different facets of human experience all in the same work and capture something just universally true about human experience. In the Divine Comedy, you get a really interesting overview of Christian and Catholic theology. You get that interwoven with classical Greek and Roman mythology. You get this first-person personal account of feeling like you're lost in life and having other people come to you to drag you out of it. You get symbols. The two people that come to Dante to take him on his journey are Virgil, the poet, from classical Rome. And Virgil for Dante symbolizes human reason, just like Spock in Star Trek symbolizes human reason. Well, Vulcan reason, but you know, logical reasoning. The achievements of what your sort of pure reason can achieve on its own. And then Beatrice, the other person that takes him the rest of the way of the journey, you know, after hell, Dante goes through purgatory and up into paradise. Those are the three parts of the Divine Comedy. Beatrice is the symbol for divine love. And, you know, Dante is using these characters to not only talk about his worldview, but capture certain truths of human experience in his mind while also incorporating the politics of the day, you know, the different circles of hell and the different people that end up there. You know, it's all the politics of the day. And of course, it's all about the 14th century, but the corrupt politicians and this, that, and the other corrupt religious figure, all of them end up, you know, symbolically placed in their own little place in hell, all woven together. And so, you know, all of this is just to say that it captures something essential about human experience. Dante feels lost. He's been banished. You know, he was in love with the real figure of Beatrice, and she rejected him, and he feels lost, and he's got to be dragged out of that. And in this story, Dante, at the beginning of the Inferno, Dante is just struggling in this dark wood, right? He's lost, he's stumbling, it's dark. And Virgil comes to him to say, I'm taking you on this journey, and I was sent by a power greater than you, and I'm going to teach you various things along the way. And of course, then Beatrice takes over and takes him the rest of the way. And I think anyone who's struggled, anyone who's felt lost, anyone who's felt lonely, anyone who's felt depressed, anyone who's had fortune not go in their favor, anyone who's had a spiritual crisis can relate to this in one way or another. Just this fundamental, in my mind, this fundamental truth of human experience is that once in a while, all of us feel lost. And the vast majority of the time, it's up to other people who care about us enough to come find us and seek us out and drag us out of it, sometimes kicking and screaming. Most of the time, it's not very willingly. And those people care enough to, you know, see it through and help us get back onto a healthier path. And in my mind, this is such a universal truth of human existence. We all go through periods like that. It all means something different for each one of us. But as I was reflecting on that, I was just thinking this happens a lot in the Star Trek universe. You mentioned the Doctor. That's a great example. The example that came immediately to my mind as I was thinking about characters that have gone astray is the character of Wesley Crusher. Mm-hmm. You know, Wesley, he starts out as this young, optimistic teenager on the Enterprise D. And, he's clearly on this path to being a Starfleet officer, just like his father, just like Captain Picard, who's a role model for him. And at a certain point, his path becomes less clear. He doesn't succeed at the Academy like he was succeeding on the Enterprise D. He gets in some trouble. When he's back, I'm thinking of the episode mainly Journey's End from The Next Generation. Wesley Crusher is, he has a bit of an attitude problem. You know, he has a problem with the people around him who are just following the Starfleet way. And it's becoming clear in his mind, and he hasn't reconciled this yet, but it's becoming clear to him that the path that other people are on and the path that he has been on is not the right path for him. And what's fascinating to me is while he's going through this crisis, the Traveler, who we've seen several times in The Next Generation, actively seeks him out and helps him understand what's going on and helps him understand that he's supposed to be on a different path. And this is, in my mind, is exactly like what's going on in the Divine Comedy. You know, Wesley Crusher is essentially in Wesley's Inferno. He's stumbling around in a dark wood alone by himself. He's not sure what path he's supposed to be on. A mystical figure comes to him and leads him on a journey. From there, we don't really know how it ends up for Wesley, although we see Wesley come back to Starfleet as an extra in Star Nemesis. Trek Nemesis, right? We see him in a Starfleet uniform, so I guess he got over it. went through hell and back and managed to find his way back to Starfleet. But in any case, Wesley, it really was up to the Traveler to help Wesley come out of this crisis that he was in and help him see that it was okay to be on a different path and he needed to be led on a new journey. And I love the scenes where the Traveler, in the guise of this Native American figure in this episode, takes him on a vision quest. You know, they get in the hammock and they have a sweat ceremony, and he has a vision of his father, and who tells him that it's okay to not follow him anymore, and it's okay to follow his own path. And you know, the rich symbolism of the fire combined with the vision quest is, you know, it's done in a different guise. It's done in the guise of a Native American vision quest type ceremony, but the core message is the same, that you know, it takes someone coming to him in a vision to lead him on a different path. It's very much like what you get in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, and I concur with you that I think the Divine Comedy is must read. I can't really articulate enough how relevant I think it is. And here's something that was written in the 14th century that is just as relevant today as it was, I think, the day it was written, because it deals with the human condition. And I think that's one of the reasons that Star Trek has endured as it has. And who knows, Zachary, maybe 1,000 years from now, people will still be looking back at Star Trek, maybe to some degree, at least in the same way that we look back at the Divine Comedy and Dante's Inferno in particular, because these are human stories dealing with the human condition. It's something that we can all relate to, whether you're a science fiction fan or not. You can relate to being a person who is transitioning from boyhood into adulthood and having that kind of identity struggle, trying to figure out what your place is in the world, where you fit in, what's your purpose in life. I mean, these are all things that, regardless of who we are, where we're from, it transcends race, it transcends culture. These are things that it transcends gender. These are things that we struggle with. That's a question that we all have to answer. We all struggle with to some degree or another. And for Wesley, he had the Traveler. And for that matter, Wesley's arc throughout Star Trek The Next Generation was one of that discovery. And having around him Captain Picard and his mother and Deanna Troi and Will Riker and Data and Geordi, having those people around him to help guide him and occasionally pull him back when he's made a wrong choice or he's kind of found himself in a conundrum of sorts and can't get out. He's got somebody there to pull him out. So I concur on all points about the Divine Comedy and Dante's Inferno. I highly recommend it. It's a must read, I think, for everyone. As I often recommend Star Trek as must see TV for everyone.
Well, there's a reason that the original series hit such an on-point note about the human condition. I'm thinking especially of the trifecta of Captain Kirk and Spock and McCoy. You know, just like in the Divine Comedy, and if you haven't read the Divine Comedy, this is going to be a little bit of Greek, pardon the pun, but the Divine Comedy is, you know, the three sort of main characters in the Divine Comedy are, of course, Dante, who's the main character. Mm-hmm. Then you get Virgil, that I mentioned, the symbol of human reason, and you get Beatrice, the symbol of divine love. And that trifecta in the Divine Comedy is very much analogous to the trifecta that you get of Captain Kirk and Spock and mm-hmm. McCoy. And just like Spock has to learn the limits of logic and the limits of that approach to solving a problem and living a life, he needs to, you know, get in touch with his human side. And McCoy is often the one to remind everyone of the importance of emotion and the importance of relationships and the importance of care. And these are things that aren't necessarily Vulcan ideals. And McCoy is the one that comes along and takes everyone the rest of the way on their journey towards the human condition in that little trifecta. Similarly, in the Divine Comedy, it's symbolic that at a certain point, Virgil is unable to take Dante on the rest of the journey. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a way of saying human reason can only take you so far, and it's Beatrice, the symbol of divine love sent from above, right, that is able to then sort of take over the journey and take Dante the rest of the way, you know, through purgatory and up all the way into paradise. And that is, I think, very much a mirror for the kind of lesson you get out of that trifecta in the original series with those three characters. You know, it's I think it's very, very clear in that the message of that trifecta is that logic alone isn't enough. Spock has to learn that lesson. It's about a family, and it's about care, and it's about the human condition, and it's about the importance of emotion and loyalty and these sort of human values, and that Spock has to learn those, and even Captain Kirk has to be reminded of those sometimes. I'm thinking of the scene in Star Trek Two, when Captain Kirk has been promoted to an admiral and he's not in command of the Enterprise anymore. He's a desk jockey now, and he's feeling old. He's feeling out of place. You know, he tells McCoy that he feels old.
He's right? In a dark place.
He's in a dark place in his own quarters. That's it exactly. And then what happens? There's a knock at the door, and it's Bones with his bottle of Romulan ale. You know, basically saying, you know, you've got to get your command back before you really do get old. You need to get back on the path you're supposed to be on. And of course, Captain Kirk can't see that yet until the events of Star Trek II. But it really is up to McCoy to remind him that, hey, you know, you've got to get back on the path you're supposed to be on. And it's with a bottle of Romulan ale, right? It's not a logical decision. You know, the logical decision is, okay, I've got all these experience. I'm going to let the young people be out on the starships. I'm going to, you know, use my experience back here at Starfleet Command. You know, that's the rational thing to do, right? The irrational, more emotional thing to do is be where you're supposed to be and be where you feel at home and be where you can, you know, be passionate about something. And Spock couldn't convey that message to Captain Kirk. It has to be McCoy that passes that message mm-hmm. along to him.
Well, you mentioned Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and you really hit the nail on the head, because Dante, Virgil, Beatrice, I mean, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, it doesn't get any more Trek than that. And oftentimes when I think about Dante's Inferno, really you could reimagine that in the Star Trek universe, and it really fits the mold of many of the episodes of Star Trek that we all love so much. I mean, you can literally take the events in Dante's Inferno and the journey that he takes and really set it in the Star Trek universe in many of these episodes, and it just completely works. You mentioned Star Trek II. When I think about Captain Kirk finding himself in somewhat of a dark place, I honestly think about Star Trek Generations, where he is trapped in the Nexus. And even though it's not a dark place, the Nexus really is a place of shadows. It's not living life. He's living a fantasy. He's really not living at all. He's just going through the motions of these various fantasies. And in particular, you know, there's the day that he, you know, decides to tell his longtime girlfriend, fiance, that he's leaving Starfleet, and he's cooking up some eggs, and you know, he's got his dog and everything's great, and you know, then there's a knock at the door, and the fantasy, the shadow, even though it was a pleasant place for him to be, it was still a dark place because he wasn't out there in the galaxy making a difference. We don't want to see Captain Kirk relaxing at a cabin in his retirement years. We want him on the bridge of a starship, or we want him on an away team making a difference. That's Captain. What makes Captain Kirk such a kick butt captain is he's always making a difference. Anything else is less than his best destiny. And so there's that knock at the door, and it's another great captain there to reach out a hand and say, listen, I'm in a difficult position. I need help. You're the guy to do it. I'm going to pull you out of this, and we're going to go save the galaxy one more time as a team. And I love that scene because, you know, Captain Kirk's on that horse and he says, you know, who am I to refuse the captain of the Enterprise? I love that because that's all he needed to kind of shake this shadow world off, is an opportunity to one more time make a difference, save the galaxy. You know, I think, and I'm getting a little sentimental here, but I think many of us find ourselves in that dark place because we've lost sight of our purpose, our best destiny in life. And I think Dante's Inferno and Generations, I think they remind us that we're all here for a purpose. We all have something to do, and anything less is just shadows. It's just an illusion. And we're challenged, you know, to find that best destiny, that next best destiny for ourselves, and go out there and make the difference that we're, you know, meant to make.
I'm glad you mentioned Captain Picard, because so often Captain Picard is in the role of, in that mentor role. He's in the position of helping someone out, you know, helping other people understand what's going on, what's important about their own lives, what's important about their careers, as the, you know, the elder person on the Enterprise D, you know, the captain who happens to be the sort of the elder person on the ship at the same time. You know, he's naturally someone that people lean on for advice. And as I think about it, I haven't thought about this very much, but as I think of Captain Picard as it relates to the Divine Comedy, I see Captain Picard as being a little closer to playing the Virgil role than playing the Beatrice role. Captain Picard generally plays the role of human reason. He's such a rational, cool exterior kind of person. And even though there's a depth to Captain Picard that doesn't really do justice to, most of the time when Captain Picard is mentoring, he's doing it from the position of logic and human reason and experience and sort of cool rationality. And on the Enterprise D, you really get something like, you get a similar kind of duality. You know, you get Captain Picard playing the role of the elder person who is experienced and has the voice of reason on his side, and you get you know, other characters that take the more emotional approach and mentor in that way. Sometimes it's Commander Riker, right? Commander Riker is the person who swings his leg over the chair, and he knows how to cook, and he likes women, and he's an emotional person. And that comes through in his being. And once in a while, he's in a position to help mentor, right? He mentors Data about the importance of those human qualities, the emotional ones, you know, in Data's journey to be more human. And then there's other characters on the Enterprise D that do that in a different way. Like, I'm thinking of Counselor Troi, obviously. She's the one who, as the counselor on the ship, is charged with the emotional well-being of everyone on the ship. So Counselor Troi is often, in my mind, you know, insofar as I'm drawing this analogy with the Divine Comedy, she's playing the Beatrice role a lot of the time, helping people understand the role of their emotions and to get themselves back on a good, healthy emotional path. And it's because she genuinely cares about them, right? Captain Picard cares in a cool, rational, captain-like kind of way, but Counselor Troi really cares in a very human, emotional kind of way. And I'm trying to think of what, you know, when does this mentoring come up the most on the Enterprise D? And the character that comes to my mind is Reginald Barclay, Lieutenant Barclay. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Barclay is someone who, you know, obviously, if you know the character, he struggles a lot, right? He has hollow addiction. He withdraws into his own fantasy land. He has social anxiety. He's got a number of problems, right? And, you know, Captain Picard and other characters on the Enterprise D play this, this sort of the Virgil role of saying, you know, Barclay, you need to get it together in one way or another. Geordi does that with him. Captain Picard does that with him. And there are several people that kind of take that rationalistic human reason approach to trying to deal with Barclay. And then there's Counselor Troi that can really sort of get through all of that and speak to Lieutenant Barclay on a more emotional level and get him in touch with what's really going on inside of him. You know, in other words, it's very similar to the Divine Comedy. I'm thinking of that episode. What is it? Hollow Pursuits, where Barclay withdraws into the holodeck, you know, in this world of fantasy. And in that story, you know, the character of Counselor Troi dressed up as the goddess of empathy.
Very, very much Beatrice.
It's very much like Beatrice. Like, you know, he's in a dark place. He's in a fantasy land. It's literally in a dreamlike state, right? You know, it's more optimistic than that because it's his own sort of, you know, projected fantasy. Mm-hmm. But he's from the objective standpoint, he's in a dark place that's not real. And these other characters come to him, and one of his fantasies is the goddess of empathy, right? He needs someone who can come to him out of compassion, understand all the things he's struggling with, and help lead him out of that dark cave and back into reality. So, yeah, in my mind, I think, you know, the goddess of empathy, Counselor Troi, you know, styled as the goddess of empathy, is very much like Beatrice in the Divine Comedy, symbolizing the importance of care and compassion and concern, and then using those qualities to help get you out of whatever trouble you're in.
I agree with you wholeheartedly about Captain Picard being more of a Virgil type character. He is very calm, cool, collected. I don't think there's a problem that he can't solve with good reasoning. He's going to sit back, he's going to weigh his options, he's going to make a decision. And we see him do this time and time again. As a mentor, we see him in that role so many times over the course of the seven seasons of Star Trek: The Next Generation, and even to some degree in the movies, we don't get to see that development as much, but we certainly see him play that role of mentor. He's the one with the cool head who is somewhat disconnected, I think, emotionally from the situations that he finds himself in, but you know, that serves him very well. He admits early on, in fact, in Encounter at Farpoint, that he's not particularly good with children because he's somewhat disconnected. He's not emotionally attached to what's going on around him. He's going to do things by the book. But we see him, Zachary, little by little, open up as the series rolls on, because I think of the Deanna Troys and the Beverly Crushers in his life. And for that matter, I think playing the role of mentor had a profound impact on him. And the fact that he is so disconnected is what makes episodes like Family so impactful, when we can peel away that tough exterior and we can see inside this man, and we see that he does feel emotion. He does love. He does hurt. He feels pain. He feels joy. Family. I think about also The Inner Light. Those episodes, I think, are what they are because we get to see inside of the Virgil character. We get to see beyond Picard's human reasoning. And he plays this mentor role so very well. And we've got several examples that we want to dig into. But one of the ones that really stands out to me, oftentimes I think probably would be overlooked by a lot of fans, and that is the role that he played in redeeming Cito Jaxa in Lower Decks from The Next Generation Season 7. Here is a young Bajoran girl who, as a cadet, was complicit in an accident that led to the death of another cadet, of course, Wesley Crusher, and a couple of other cadets were involved in. We won't get into a synopsis of the episode, but she finds herself in the seventh season actually stationed on Enterprise. And we find out in the episode that she's not there by accident. Captain Picard actually requested her. And we don't realize that at first because it seems like he's being very, very hard on her. But he has this way of bringing out the very best in people. And he certainly does this for Cito Jaxa. The unfortunate thing is, at the end of the episode, spoilers, everyone, Cito is killed on the mission. But what he's able to do for her in the course of Lower Decks is just nothing short of miraculous, and it really brings what could have been just a throwaway character from, you know, a previous season. It really brings her character full circle, and we get to see what she's able to do, what she's able to accomplish, and her redemption as a result of Captain Picard's masterful mentoring.
You know, this is a really interesting line of reasoning, thinking of Captain Picard as playing the role of Virgil in the Divine Comedy, because there are so many parallels. Dante is given a dressing down several mm-hmm. times in the Inferno by Virgil, who chastises him for being afraid, really, you know, gives him a very hard-nosed push on this journey, basically telling, you've got nothing to worry about, follow me, I'm going to lead you. And generally, Virgil is in the position of a leader in the Divine Comedy, just like Captain Picard is the vast majority of the time in the position of being a leader. He's the one who has to project an air of confidence that other people have to follow and be confident in. You know, if other people are being, afraid, or if they've strayed in some way, Captain Picard has to give them the hard push to get back on the track. And yet in the Divine Comedy, there are places where even Virgil, displays some fear in light of the things that he's seeing. There are things that are so disturbing that are depicted inside the Inferno that even Virgil shudders a little bit out of fear. And once in a while, Captain Picard lets his guard down like that. And you can see sort of behind the confident mask that there's this sort of human emotional element, whether it's fear or whether it's an emotional connection, whether it's trying to help someone where it's not logical, whatever it is. But there's a deeper interior to Captain Picard's outward appearance, and it's very much much like how Virgil is portrayed in the Inferno, I think. You know, there's this air of confidence, having been sent on a divine mission to take Dante on this journey, and having the power of the divine behind him, he can sort of command, you know, people to get out of their path all along this journey. You know, get out of my way. I'm, you know, leading Dante on this journey through hell, you know, in the Inferno. And yet once in a while, you know, that cool exterior breaks down, and you can see the person behind the exterior in that scenario.
Yeah, and we talked about Wesley Crusher earlier and his interaction with the Traveler in Journey's End. But we actually see Captain Picard play this role for Wesley many times as well.
More than the Traveler.
More so than the Traveler. And oftentimes it's not the gentle nudge. Sometimes it's the dressing down. It's just the hard facts of human reasoning. You know, Wesley, you've got to get your act together. You have to be a man. And I'm summarizing, but those are the conversations that he's able to have with Wesley, and he's in many respects a father figure. And Wesley acknowledges that. Inside the Star Trek universe, Wesley acknowledges that Captain Picard is very much a father figure, not because he's warm and fuzzy and, you know, he's just pouring love and affection on him, but because he's there with reason, with understanding, and he's handing it to him in oftentimes a very hard way.
So if Captain Picard is in the role of Virgil for Wesley, you know, who plays the role of Beatrice? Who's the counterpoint to that? There are several candidates, and I don't think it's really, I think his mother is the obvious candidate. His mother is the nurturer in his life, while Captain Picard gets to play the father figure generally. But are there other influences that you know, we talked a lot about Virgil, but are there other influences in Wesley's life in particular that play that emotional role, the role of in the Divine Comedy, it's Beatrice symbolizing divine love. But is there some analogous counterpoint in Wesley's life besides his mother?
Besides his mother, surprisingly enough, it seems like oftentimes the
Robin Loeffler,
Robin Loeffler for sure. But it seems strange for me to say, and I'm almost hesitant to say it, but I oftentimes see Geordi and for that matter Data playing that role. Data, of all people, we wouldn't really imagine in the role of Beatrice, but, you know, for the android who doesn't really experience emotion, at least apart from his emotion chip, he really oftentimes plays that softer role.
Well, that's actually the next stage play that Dr. Crusher is going to put on the Enterprise. They're going to do a stage performance, The Divine Comedy, and Data is going to play Beatrice.
Well, I'm in all seriousness, I'm thinking back to First Duty. I alluded to that earlier when I was talking about Ceta Jaxa, but in First Duty, Wesley gets a dressing down from Captain Picard, a very stern dressing down. But it seems like the support and kind of the emotional support that he needs is coming from Geordi, coming from Data. And it seems very odd for me to say that, but again, I see that kind of softer approach, the divine love, the empathy coming from those characters who are very prevalent in Wesley's life, who have a great deal of influence on him. I think those are probably his two best friends, if you will, whereas Captain Picard is more like a father figure, and then he's got Commander Riker, who is to some degree a father figure or an uncle. And then you have his mom, of course. I think Deanna probably is more of an aunt to him rather than a friend. But his friends are Data and Geordi, and they're often the counterpoint to that hard-nosed human reasoning.
Well, in that episode, First Duty, I love that Captain Picard reminds everyone that Wesley is one of their own, mm-hmm. right? So when there's an investigation going on, everyone is very proactive about trying to help Wesley. And they don't have to do that, right? They have the other things they need to do on the ship, right? Geordi's got his job, and Data's got his job, and Captain Picard has his job. They don't need to spend time on this investigation, given that, you know, Starfleet Academy has their own investigation, right? They don't need to interfere. But, and in my mind, that's just very similar to the Divine Comedy too. Virgil doesn't need to come out of his place in limbo to go help Dante. Beatrice, who's in paradise in the Divine Comedy, doesn't need to leave paradise to go help Dante. That's not an essential characteristic. They get sent on this divine mission, and it's one out of care and compassion. It's going out of your way to help someone else when you really don't need to do that. And I think that's what's going on in First Duty. You have people who are going out of their way to help Wesley. Counter to reason, you know, when the evidence starts to point in, you know, in a direction that shows that Wesley's gotten involved in something he shouldn't have been involved in, the situation leading up to this accident, trying to do the stunt that they weren't supposed to do, the forbidden maneuver, the covert starburst maneuver, right?
Yes.
You know, but despite the fact they don't need to interfere, they do. They go out of their way to help Wesley because they care and he's one of their own. And that's, again, I just think that's such an important feature of human nature, that anytime someone helps anyone else, the vast majority of the time, it's not necessary. I guess there is a component to human nature that's a little selfish, like you help someone else because it really helps you in the process. That certainly happens too. But I'm thinking of the truly altruistic, selfless kind of help where it's not necessary and you're just comfortable where you're at and you're getting involved when you don't need to be, all because you just plain care about someone and it's the right thing to do. You know, and then, you know, hopefully at the end of the situation, you end up better off. And it really does take a dressing down from Captain Picard for Wesley to see the error of his ways, and at least for the short term to get back on the path he's supposed to be on until his next identity crisis in Journey's End. You know, Wesley seems to have this come up every couple years. He goes through an identity crisis and someone's got to drag him out of it. And it's like the ante gets up every time, you know, when he's young, it's like, okay, Geordi needs to teach him how to deal with women. And that's his identity crisis, which is a lost cause right there. Let me tell you.
Isn't that the truth of life though, Zachary? I mean, when we're young, those things seem so serious at the time, but the stakes are really pretty low. I mean, you know, when I'm a 14-year-old boy and I'm interested in a girl and, you know, she's not giving me the time of day and it just feels like the world has come to a screeching halt, it's all ending.
Well, don't ask Geordi.
I'm in the 10th circle of hell. I'm definitely not getting girl advice from Geordi or, for that matter, Harry Kim. But it seems like that's the end of the world. But in reality, we can look back and realize the stakes really weren't that high. But as we get older, the ante really does get upped and the stakes are higher and we find ourselves in more difficult situations. But we manage through those and we gain strength to face whatever challenges that we find tomorrow until we find something else that's, you know, that's really too big for us. And then, you know, Virgil has to show up with reasoning and Beatrice has to come in with empathy and love. And I think about divine dressing downs, as it were, from Captain Picard. I also have to think about Commander Riker in Pegasus. You know, he's torn between his loyalty to Pressman, his former captain, and his loyalty to Captain Picard, his current captain. And he gets quite a dressing down in that episode from his current captain and from his former captain, for that matter. But, you know, at the end of the episode, we know that Captain Picard is always right. Captain Picard knows best. But he really gives Riker a swift kick in the pants, metaphorically speaking.
Well, Mike, you know, as we saw in the last episode of Enterprise, these are the voyages. It's the goddess of empathy, once again, that comes to Riker and helps put him back on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, we didn't know that until These Are the Voyages. Up until that point, we just assumed that it was Virgil Picard. And
no, it was actually the goddess of empathy the whole time. Well, Mike, I'm glad you mentioned the sort of difference in scale as you go through life's journey of the problems you encounter, because I think that's so true. When you're, I mean, and don't get me wrong, you know, I've actually had a pretty good life compared to a lot of people, right? There are people who've had some really terrible things happen to them at a really young age. And, you know, this is not everyone's experience for sure. But, you know, generally, as you get older, I think you're right. The stakes get a little higher. The problems take on a more serious tone to them. You know, the kinds of things you struggle with, the lighthearted things that you struggle with as a teenager are not as deep or important or as significant as the things you deal with at middle age. And, you know, what that'll be like in 20 or 30 more years, I have no idea. I'm not there yet, right? But in the Divine Comedy, I think it's no accident that this... scenario, this fault going astray and being led on a journey happens, and it says explicitly the very beginning of the Divine Comedy, midway through life's journey, I found myself, you know, in the dark wood. You know, he's not a teenager, he's not an old person, he's midway through the journey of life. You know, he's about 35 years old. He's not quite middle aged, probably. And that's about the point at which, you know, there's a reason we have a term for it, midlife crisis. Right? Dante's essentially going through a midlife crisis, literally. But all there's this youthful quality to Dante. Like, he's had this youthful, you know, fairly romantic, youthful experience. And all of that has fallen through. It's not gone the way he wanted. And now he's having a midlife crisis. And it's at that age, the midlife crisis, where this journey that you experience in the Divine Comedy happens to him. You know, I don't think this kind of journey can happen to you when you are young. You don't understand the significance of it yet. You can't appreciate what's necessary to get out of those situations. When you're old, it doesn't matter anymore. You've gone through it all. You've gone through the struggles. You're at the end of the journey at that point. It's really, I think, people who are around our age, you know, 30s to 40s, that have enough experience where they can understand the significance and the weight and appreciate the help when it comes. And that seems to be the right age that this kind of crisis happens. So, you know, it's in my mind, it's really no accident that as Wesley is, you know, he ceased being a teenager, he's done with, you know, creeping up and being done with Starfleet Academy. He's, you know, he's not middle aged, but he's getting there. He's not a teenager anymore. That's when the most significant kind of midlife crisis starts to happen for Wesley. He's, you know, he's questioned all of his previous experience, and the Traveler comes to him and shows him a different path. And he goes for it. And I don't think that could have happened to Wesley at a younger age. And when he's older, the stakes are lower in a way, because, you know, he's already gone through those struggles and he's at the end of the journey. And what's the point at that point, I think, right? So, again, this is just kind of my take on it, being about the age I'm at, 37, and you're a little older than I am. But I can't imagine, I didn't understand the significance of the Divine Comedy when I first read it in high school. And I think, you know, without that kind of experience of really struggling to know who you are and struggling to know, you know, how to deal with your problems, and having had enough experience where you really genuinely appreciate the people that have come into your life totally of their own doing, because they care about you, to drag you out of it. That's when I think you can really appreciate those things. And I don't think you could write or appreciate a work like the Divine Comedy as a younger person.
Indeed, I agree. And as you said that, it just reiterates to me, particularly Wesley Crusher, how much his journey, his arc in the Star Trek universe, really in many ways is identical to Dante's journey. And even though we don't have a single Virgil character and a single Beatrice character, it occurs to me that he's surrounded by these characters who are always there to help kind of pick him up and push him through. So, you know, it's Wesley's Inferno out there. Maybe that's the new title of Star Trek The Next Generation. Maybe we should just call it Wesley's Inferno. But it just occurs to me, as you were saying that, just how much his journey reminds me of Dante's. And for that matter, I also have to, my mind has to go to Tom Paris as well, because I think just as Wesley's overall arc is an arc of discovery, I think Tom Paris's story is much the same way. He's not as young as Wesley. He's an adult who has spent his entire life really making childish decisions, foolish decisions. But he's no longer a kid, so he doesn't have that as an excuse. When we first meet Tom Paris, he's very much juvenile in his manner, in his way of thinking, and that's gotten him into some trouble. And when we meet Tom, he is in a very dark place. He's in a penal colony in New Zealand. It's not really a dark place. It actually looks pretty.
It's rather sunny.
It looks really nice, actually. It looks very pleasant, but he's not glad to be there. And it's certainly nowhere that no right thinking person would want to be. And Janeway finds him there and recruits him for the Maquis mission.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Tom Paris and Captain Janeway, because the situation on Voyager is a little bit different than the situation you see on the Enterprise D. You know, I think on the Enterprise D, you really get a strong duality. You've got Captain Picard, who plays the role of reason, and you've got, and sometimes Data does that as well. I mean, Data is a type of Spock character as well, so Data can play that role, but you also have these very clear symbols of either maternal influence, like you see in Dr. Mm-hmm. Crusher, or an emotional influence, like you see in Counselor Troy. And they're very bifurcated. You know, those roles don't mix very much. What I think is really interesting about Captain Janeway is that she really combines both the Virgil and the Beatrice role in the same character. Captain Janeway is the one who comes to Tom Paris out of reason and to drag him out of prison in New Zealand and puts him on
kicking
a journey.
Kicking and screaming.
Right? It's kicking and screaming. But in that sense, she's analogous to Virgil. Virgil is the first person to seek out Dante, and he does it out of reason, right? You know, it's not out of care so much. It's out of helping Dante reason his way out of the situation that he's gone through by showing him, you know, these various experiences. And then, of course, you know, Beatrice takes over at a certain point, and that's from a different motivation. But Captain Janeway, her initial motivation is not to necessarily help Tom Paris.
No, right? She's got a mission.
She's got a mission to do, and in that sense, she's projecting very much a cool exterior where she's not emotionally moved at all by whatever difficulties Tom Paris has had in life. She wants to get her mission done, and she's going to use Tom Paris to do it. So I think in that sense, it's almost it's Virgil-like, but even Virgil has a little bit of care for Dante, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit of compassion for the situation that he finds him in. I don't think Captain Janeway has an ounce of compassion in her when she first encounters Tom Paris. It takes a little while for Captain Janeway to warm up to him. And then, of course, you know, throughout the series of Voyager, what I like about Captain Janeway, I like the compassion that she brings to her role as captain. People have kind of joked that she mothers her crew, but, you know, she does. She's not just their captain. Captain Picard can very much stand back and say, I'm the captain, you know, do follow my orders, and I'm not going to get involved. And that's not Captain Janeway. Captain Janeway will become emotionally involved with the people under her command and go out of her way to help them out of care, out of compassion. Mm-hmm. And Picard really has to work at that. And I think that comes a bit more intuitive for Captain Janeway, even though when the very first time we see Captain Janeway reaching out to Tom Paris, she's all, prickles and stings, right? she's not, you know, playing the compassionate role there. And her ability to combine both of those qualities in the very same character, I think is somewhat unique to Captain Janeway amongst the Star Trek captains.
But I love after Caretaker how she is able to own the role that she's been given in the lives of her crew. I mean, she just owns it. But I have to push back just a little bit in her role as Beatrice in Tom's life, because I really think that role for Tom, and this is going to probably surprise a lot of people, I think that role really belongs to Harry Kim.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, without a doubt, it's the buddy relationship of Tom and Tom and Harry.
Tom and Harry. But
Tom and Harry. Tom, Dick,
but Zachary,
and Harry, right?
don't you agree that relationship, Harry's willingness to be his friend in spite of everything? I mean, he knows the truth, and he still accepts Tom. I think that Beatrice relationship is really what redeems him.
And I think that's right. I think in the Divine Comedy, Virgil starts Dante on his journey, but Virgil doesn't go all the way with him. He's not able mm-hmm. to, right? And it's symbolic. It's symbolic of Dante's view that human reason can't lead to salvation and perfection, right? That's something that love can do. It's not something that reason can do. So there's a deep symbolism there, and it's tied up with Dante's Catholic worldview. But you know, I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's Harry Kim that it will go all the way with Tom as his friend, much more so than any other character on Voyager, maybe with the exception of B'Elanna.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. But yeah, it just strikes me how much Tom's journey in Voyager resembles Dante's indeed.
And this comes up a few times for Tom, right? I mean, yes, he's in prison at the beginning of Voyager and Caretaker, but I'm thinking of the episode 30 Days mm-hmm. when he's in a brig and he's realized that he's made some mistakes again, and we get to kind of get a firsthand look inside Tom Paris's mind when he's writing letters to his father that he doesn't even know if his father will ever receive. But again, it's Captain Janeway that really plays the most active role in redeeming Tom's view of himself, I think, in that episode. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I really do. It's tough love. It really is. I mean, this is no nonsense. Yes, Tom, I think what you did on the surface was very noble, but it was still the wrong thing. And I'm going to take you down a notch. Literally, I'm going to take you down a pip.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can kind of jokingly put it in Divine Comedy terms, like, you know, I'm going to take you to hell and back, but you're going to be the better for it, and it's going to be okay in the end.
Yes,
and it's not going to be. That doesn't mean it's going to be an easy journey. And I think that's one of the things that's most interesting to me about the Divine Comedy is, you know, Virgil doesn't just take him on a happy journey. He takes him on a very dark and disturbing journey through the depths of the human, the dark side of the human experience. You know, all the bad things that people can do, and the worst of human nature. And he needs to expose Dante to all of that to teach him a lesson about the things that are good about the human experience, and about the right and good things in the world, and about his own nature. And the role that care and love can play in relation to all these bad things. You know, there's a very deep lesson there, but it's not an easy lesson to learn. And I think that tough love approach is definitely something that Janeway is more than willing to do with Tom Paris, to take a tough love approach with him to teach him a lesson. And but also knowing that it will be okay. It's a tough love and it's a difficult journey. Tom Paris has to suffer. You know, it's a little bit of humiliation too. He gets demoted to an ensign, mm-hmm. right? Again, and that's hard for him, you know. And you know, but those kinds of things, you know, are done. There's a kind of a dual nature to it. It's you know, it's Captain Janeway taking him on this journey that is going to be difficult, but it's also done with the right intention, knowing that it will teach him a lesson and it will be okay in the end, and he'll learn something from it. But that doesn't mean you get to skip all the lessons along the way.
Indeed.
And if anyone can say that you don't get to skip the lessons, this is what, you know, I think I hear Captain Janeway saying that almost more than any of the other captains, that this, you know, this is a lesson you're going to learn, and here's how you're going to learn it. And I don't picture Captain Picard putting it quite in those terms. I think Captain Janeway is very much able to say, we're going on a journey and it's going to be tough, but it's what you have to do.
It's true for Dante. It's true for Tom Paris. It's true for these other characters that we've been talking about. I've made an observation in my own life, and as you mentioned, I'm a little bit older. I'm 45. I'm not a young man anymore. And I've made an observation in my life, and again, this is true of Dante. This is true of these characters that we love so much in the Star Trek universe. We oftentimes don't grow as a result of our victories. It's those dark moments, those dark places, those hard lessons. Those are oftentimes the places that we grow the most. And I think in Tom's life, that's certainly true. I think it's certainly true in Wesley's life. But it strikes me that our quintessential, or maybe rather not so quintessential, Klingon, Worf, I think that's been true of him too, because here's another character, and I think it's by virtue of the fact that he's in two of these series that we love, we get to see an interesting arc for him as well. We get to see him go to at least the ninth circle of hell a couple times, not so much like B'Elanna, who literally goes to hell. But Worf metaphorically finds himself in some dark places over the course of his character's arc throughout The Next Generation and the seasons of Deep Space Nine. We get to see him further develop. And we get to see Captain Picard, Sisko, Jadzia. We get to see him interact and be rescued, if you will, by those characters as well.
How did we not think to talk about Barge of the Dead when we're talking about the Inferno.
Indeed.
Because, I mean, in a way, this is like straight out of the Inferno, too, because there's a scene where, of course, there's this whole geography of hell in the Divine Comedy, right? There's the River Styx and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dante and Virgil have to get on the boat. And, you know, this is stuff that's actually straight out of the Inferno,
yes.
too. And all of that is, you know, informs these episodes like Barge of the Dead. But I didn't think to talk about Barge of the Dead, so I don't have much to say about it, really. But I love that the imagery is somewhat taken out of these very classic scenes from the Inferno.
Oh, it's right out.
And classical mythology,
of course, it's right out. Klingon mythology is straight out of our own. The imagery is spot on. I don't think it's a happy accident at all. I think that imagery is there for a reason. I think it points, you know, straight back to, you know, certainly human mythology, Greek mythology, Roman mythology. Absolutely.
Mike, I'm glad you thought to mention Worf, because Worf is a character, like you mentioned, that struggled about many different things. He struggled with his Klingon identity, having been raised by humans. He struggled with whether he wants to stay in Starfleet or not when he gets to Deep Space Nine. And there are definite people in Worf's life that have helped drag him out of it in various places. Captain Picard definitely plays that Virgil role. Even Commander Riker plays that role for Worf when Worf is entertaining the idea of committing
yes.
suicide. Worf is in a very dark place, and it's Commander Riker that comes to him saying, "No, I'm not gonna do this with you. I'm gonna show you a different way." And it's not really clear that he's playing either Virgil or either the Beatrice role there. You know, it's clearly one of friendship where he just says, "I know what's better for you, and I'm not gonna let you go down this path. At least, and if you are." I'm not going to be a part mm-hmm. of it. It's a little bit different than what you're seeing in the Divine Comedy, because it's not that Riker goes on a journey with Worf. Riker is saying, "I'm off this train. If you're going down this path, I can't go yeah. with you on this because I think it's wrong. And I know there's a better way, and you just don't see it yet, and I'm not going to be involved." And that's a different kind of tough love than you see in the Divine Comedy. But it is a friend reaching out in a very almost ironic kind of way. He's helping by not helping, mm-hmm. right? And then, of course, you know, when Worf gets to Deep Space Nine, Captain Sisko plays a different kind of role for him, and of course, Jadzia, as his you know future wife, plays the role of divine
definitely
love.
Definitely Beatrice.
Obviously for yeah, definitely a Beatrice role. You know, across the board there, I think for Worf. But Worf has people again who just reach into his life and help drag him onto a different path, a path that he's supposed to be on, or to teach him some lesson about himself. And I think that this is one of the things I love about Worf. Worf struggles in a deeper way than a lot of characters that you see in Star Trek. And I've always related to that about Worf. You know, when Worf gets in a funk, he's not just in a little funk; he's in a Worf-like funk.
Yeah.
and he's got to have someone really go dig deep and drag him out of it, and in a way that's much deeper than Wesley's struggles, and much deeper than other characters, even deeper than Tom Paris's struggles. I think Worf's struggles are really deep, to the point where he's willing to, you know, shove a knife in his own chest sometimes, and that's just a different kind of deep than I see in other characters.
That's not a Klingon thing to do, is it?
It's not, but he has characters that will drag him out of it, and I love that. But you know, Worf can't do it himself. Worf will continue to spiral downward unless someone drags him out of it.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I think about the episode Rules of Engagement, when Worf let's call it what it is. He's made a mistake. He's made a tactical error, and now he finds himself. You know, facing extradition to the Klingon Empire for it. And even though he was framed, he still made a tactical error. And I love the scene near the end of that episode. Worf is, they've won, but Worf is still sitting in his dark place, Zachary. He's not relishing the victory because he recognizes that he made a tactical error, and it was that error that put him, and I think he's feeling a sense of guilt because he's drug his captain into this. I think there are a lot of things going on for our Klingon here, but I love when Captain Sisko shows up at his door and invites him to the party. You know, they're throwing a party in the wardroom for you. Come on, you know, you got to come to the party. And he recognizes that Worf's kind of wallowing in his own self-pity. And I love the fact that Sisko takes on that dual role there, because he kind of shows up as Beatrice, but before that conversation's over, he goes all Virgil on him. You know, do you know what you did wrong? And you know, he's able to, Worf is able to recognize his mistake. What's Sisko's answer when he recognizes his mistake? Was it a pat on the shoulder? Said, "It's okay, buddy. No harm, no foul. Uh-uh. I'm going to give you one more kick, and then we're going to go down here to this party because I don't want you to forget this mistake you made, and I want you to grow beyond this." And I love that. I love the way that Captain Sisko is able to do that, and he does it. We talked about how masterful Captain Picard was. I don't think Sisko gets enough credit, enough props, because he really embodies both of these roles so very well.
And I love that Worf, for all of his Klingon exterior, all Worf really wants to do in the time of a crisis, he just wants to hide in his quarters and play Klingon opera, right? I mean, and this happens a couple of times. I mean, there's the time when, you know, Worf has just got his discommendation, and you know, there's going to be another Klingon coming on the ship, and Worf doesn't want to escort the Klingon, you know, from the transporter room. He wants to have another officer do it. So Worf wants to tuck tail and hide. Because of his discommendation. And of course, you know, after having gone through the experience that we mentioned in this episode, after having, you know, almost been extradited to the Klingon Empire to face trial, you know, Worf just wants to hide on the Defiant. He's not going to go to his party. And it takes, you know, Captain Picard says, you're not going to run and hide every time a Klingon ship uncloaks. And Captain Sisko says, sometimes you got to go to the party when you don't want to,
yes.
You know, and that's just part of being a Starfleet officer. It's part of being a captain. It's part of being an adult. And, you know, Worf, for all of his Klingon toughness, is very juvenile in his thinking about such things. And he needs a mentor to say, I'm sorry, Worf, you know, despite your Klingonness, you need to grow up.
Yeah.
and Captain Sisko does that very well, but Captain Picard does it too. Captain Picard doesn't let Worf get away with that very much.
Yeah, I love the fact that Worf recognizes that life's a little more difficult when you're wearing red.
Right.
And Sisko's response to that is, hey, wait till you get another pip on your collar. You think it's tough now?
You think it's tough wearing red on Deep Space Nine? Try it in the original series.
No doubt. Well, Zachary, as we move along here, and it's... You know, we've gone past an hour at this point and probably ought to be wrapping up. We've got some other examples, but we noted in the Turbo Lift that some of these examples don't really fit Dante's Inferno as well as others. And we had some other examples that I think are worth mentioning that I don't think really fit the mold as well, but certainly there are elements of the stories, I think, that line up to the Divine Comedy and Dante's Inferno.
Well, the one that comes to my mind immediately is Captain Sisko. At the beginning of Deep Space Nine, Captain Sisko is in a very dark place, right? His wife has been killed in the attack with the Borg. He doesn't want to be assigned to Deep Space Nine, but he's being sort of, you know, sent out to the boondocks. You know, he doesn't want to do it. He wants to raise his son, and he wants to sulk, and, you know, he's really doesn't know, not sure if he wants to remain in Starfleet. And, you know, so he's in that dark place, but there's no one person that kind of helps drag him out. I mean, Captain Picard definitely gives him a bit of a talking to, but that's not helpful. In fact, it probably pushes him a little further away, right? It kind of backfires a little bit. And even when Captain Sisko gets to, at that point, Commander Sisko, he's not a captain yet, but when Commander Sisko gets to Deep Space Nine, there's no one person there that reaches out to him to help drag him out of it. You know, in it, for Sisko, it really is kind of this quasi-religious spiritual enlightenment that happens in him. You know, Kai Opaka, you know, thinks he's the emissary. He has this experience, what could be termed a religious experience, with the prophets in the wormhole. And it's some combination of the prophets and Kai Opaka that help him reframe his life and see it in a different context and start to embrace this new life that he has on Deep Space Nine with this religious significance as the emissary that gives his life new meaning and re-energizes him. But it's not as simple as a friend or a mentor or, you know, an individual or two reaching out to Sisko and dragging him, putting him on a journey. He's definitely on a journey, and he's being sent there by totally accidental reasons, right? He just happens to get assigned to Deep Space Nine. There's nothing terribly essential about him that makes him the right person to be in command of Deep Space Nine. It's not quite a type of punishment. That doesn't sound right either, but it's definitely not an ideal post, and he's not an ideal officer at that point in his career, and they're assigning him to kind of babysit the space station, you know, and to oversee the Bajorans coming into the Federation. So there is that that trust element. They're trusting an important mission to him there, but it's not an ideal post, and there's nothing glamorous about it. And no one's helping, you know, recognizing that he's in trouble and he needs some help. And it takes this, this, you know, quasi-religious experience for him to reframe his life. So it's similar to the Divine Comedy insofar as I think there's this spiritual component to it. You know, the prophets reach out to him and Kaiopaka mm-hmm. reach out to him, but it's not any of his friends. It's not any mentors that he has. And he's kind of thick-skulled about it. It takes sure. a while for it to sink in.
The theologian in me goes to the term providence. This was an act of providence. He was chosen, absolutely, from birth, right? He was in the place he was supposed to be at the right time. And I think very much so early on, even though we didn't see very much of her, Kaiopaka really does represent in a large way Beatrice, because she shows up very briefly, but there's this passion, there's this love and this concern for her people and for the prophets, and that shines through. And in fact, the few times that we get to see her in Deep Space Nine, it's that quiet, reserved passion that wins everybody, and it wins us as fans. I mean, she's a fan favorite for a reason. It's because of this reserved passion. But the prophets very much represent Virgil, the human reasoning, because they don't understand feelings. They don't even understand linear time. They just cause him to look introspectively at himself and realize that he's stuck in a rut. He's literally stuck on that ship at Wolf 359, and he's never gotten past it. And that's what really starts his journey.
Are you saying that he exists there?
He lives there. He exists there.
I think you're right, though, that Kaiopaka is a fan favorite. What I like about her, I like her sort of authentic zeal.
You
get a kind of zealousness from Kai Winn that is forced and inauthentic, and you get a genuine quiet fervor and authentic zeal to Kaiopaka that it's so authentic, and it cuts through all of that and speaks to Sisko in some way. And of course, you know, the fact that all of this experience happens in a dreamlike state is very much like the Divine Comedy. This isn't a normal part of an experience. It's in the context of a vision quest or an out-of-body experience. You know, just like in the Divine Comedy, this happens essentially in a dream or in a dreamlike state. It's not something that happens in waking experience. So there is that component of it as well. It's an interesting metaphor, but it doesn't really like naturally match up. Like you mentioned that you think the prophets serve this Virgil role, playing the role of reason. I don't know if I quite see that myself. I mean, they seem almost neutral. I mean, they don't seem to have compassion for Sisko, right? They don't even understand linear sure. time, right? So they don't understand the state that he's in. You know, Kaiopaka, is she reaching out to Captain Sisko out of care and concern and sort of love in the Beatrice kind of sense? Or is it, you know, sort of the fulfillment of her own, you know, theological view? I mean, there's definitely an authentic belief mm-hmm. to it and an excitement about that. But is it out of compassion for Sisko himself? I'm not sure. What do you think?
Yes, on both counts. And I can say that as someone who has spent over 25 years in ministry. I do it because I genuinely love people. And I see that in Kaiopaka. So I think she does act out of her love. She sees a gentleman that she has compassion for. She sees that he's lost. She sees that he needs to start this journey. And I think there's a sense of divine love, divine compassion in a literal sense there.
Well, now that you put it in those terms, I think you're right. I think you're right. Kaiopaka seems to sense that Captain Sisko is in pain mm-hmm. or is hurting in some way. There's an intuitiveness to her reaction with him that she can kind of see through the exterior and understand where he's at. She recognizes that his paw is strong, for example, mm-hmm. right? And so I think in that sense, you're right. You know, she recognized that he's hurting. She doesn't really have the answer for him necessarily. In fact, you know, if anything, his role as the emissary is going to make things even more complicated in a lot of ways. But she at least recognizes that he's hurting, and she's in a position to lead him on a start him on a journey. In that sense, it's more like Virgil. She can't go with him the rest of the way on the journey right. either. You know, she's not around on Deep Space Nine to do that. Just like Virgil doesn't go with Dante all the way to paradise in the Divine Comedy. She can start him on the journey. She recognizes that he's suffering. So I actually kind of see Opaka playing the Virgil role, you know, where she starts him on the journey. She recognizes that he's suffering. She's not able to go with him all the way. You know, there's an intuitive concern for him, but it's not, she can't be the one to guide him all the way.
Yeah, I agree with that to some degree. But when we see Kai Opaka again in Battle Lines, we see her in that Beatrice role again for Kira. And then she stays there, obviously because she has to, but she's okay with it because she can reach out to these prisoners, if you will, with that passion, that divine love, that divine need to show them a better way. And she's going to stay there and make a difference.
And I think what I like about this, the way we're characterizing this now, is that it really does kind of parallel what's going on in the Divine Comedy. You know, in the Divine Comedy, Virgil doesn't have access to all of the information, right? Virgil has never been to paradise. He was born pre-Christ, not able to achieve salvation, and according to Dante's own, you know,
theological
view in the Divine Comedy. Yeah, exactly. It's very kind of Catholic worldview. Virgil just doesn't have all the information, right? Whereas it's Beatrice that kind of can step back, having been to paradise, having been sent on an explicit mission, you know, from the divine to go seek out Dante through Virgil. You know, Beatrice has a much more spiritual, global, deeper perception of the reality of the situation than even Virgil has, I think. And it's Kai Opaka who can kind of see, you know, Sisko's role in that bigger metaphysical, spiritual picture. Kai Opaka has a lot more information than Captain Sisko does. And she can put it in that terminology. And I think even in the Divine Comedy, Virgil can't do that. Virgil is coming to Dante, not from paradise, but Virgil is coming from limbo, having been sent by Beatrice, who was sent by the divine. And it's not until he gets through the inferno. And in fact, we should dwell just a little bit on Dante's mental state at the beginning of the Divine Comedy. All Dante can see is the dark wood with, you know, beasts who are blocking his every path. He encounters the gates of hell, and that's all he can see. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. It's written above the gates of hell and the inferno. And that's the field of Dante's view. And Virgil expands that a little bit. He takes him through the gate and says, you don't have to be afraid. We're going on a journey. But still, all of Dante's field of view is everything dark and dank. And nothing glorious about Dante's journey, except for Virgil's reassurance that it's going to be okay at the end of the day, and there's a purpose to this. But it's Beatrice who can take that larger perspective and give Dante the hope that he needs to see, beyond this dark sphere that he starts that defines his field of view at the beginning of the Divine Comedy. And I think in that sense, Kai Opaka plays that similar role for Captain Sisko. All Captain Sisko can see at the beginning of Deep Space Nine is this, you know, fairly narrow, dark field of view. He's lost his wife. He's lost his ship was blown up. He doesn't want to be in command of Deep Space Nine. And there he is. Nothing has gone his way. It's all terrible. And it's Kai Opaka who can kind of expand his field of view and get him to see all of those events in a different context, in a different light. And it's no accident, I think, that, you know, all of his experiences are in this hazy, you know, light filled environment, right? You know, he needs an injection of light into his life, because he starts out in a very dark place at the beginning of Deep Space Nine, and it's not a reason that does that. It's Kai Opaka's larger, more spiritual view that sheds that light on the dark situation that he's in.
Indeed. Well, Zachary, I just hit on a couple other quick ones, more or less for my final thoughts. I thought of Kira in the Deep Space Nine Season 1 episode Progress. And this is an interesting one. And again, it doesn't really fit the narrative of Dante's Inferno very well. But there's the parallel in that Kira has been sent to go expel a farmer from this moon, and he's not wanting to go. So she's been sent there. Her mission is to get him out of there, so you know they can terraform, do what they need to do. And he's not willing to go. But over the course of this, she finds herself really sympathizing with him, and you know she's staying there with him, and she's starting to see things from his perspective. And all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door, and it's Commander Sisko rather. And he's there to give her a swift kick in the butt. And at the end, she ends up burning down his house in order to give him that sense of tough love and help push him along in his journey. So, you know, in the fact that, you know, she's there for the farmer, and she ends up, you know, having to, in many respects, reach out and grab a hand to be pulled out herself. To some degree, I see some parallels there. I think of T'Pol and her Trillium addiction and the relationship that she had with Phlox in the course of that, and how, in many respects, he was both a Virgil and a Beatrice character, being that they're the only two aliens on Enterprise. There was that natural relationship that they had, very, very much friends and confidants of one another, and he was both a voice of reason and the expression of compassion as she struggled with her addiction.
I'm glad you mentioned Major Kira, because you know Kira is a character that really does have her demons that crop up from time to time, and she's definitely got a character arc in Deep Space Nine. But I was actually thinking that for Major Kira, it's actually Odo and Major Kira who are kind of both playing Virgil and Beatrice to each other, you know, insofar as they're on this trajectory toward being in a romantic relationship with each other. They really have bonded. It takes them a while to realize it, but they've bonded together and they help each other out in lots of ways. And there's kind of a romantic component to that. And it's interesting because even in the Divine Comedy, despite all of this darkness and despite all of this mysticism and despite all of the metaphors that you get, there is kind of this just plain straightforward romanticism to the Divine Comedy, insofar as Beatrice was for Dante a symbol of divine love. It was someone he idolized, someone he thought he wanted to be with, someone he loved who rejected him. And his earlier poetry accounts for all that. And it's just a romantic story at this, at a very basic level. Despite all the other richness, there's a romantic story behind the Divine Comedy, and you can see that, I think, with Odo and Major Kira. You know, they help each other in lots of ways, but fundamentally it's a romance at the end of the day, and I like seeing that. You know, the episodes that bring that delight appeal to me as kind of a romantic individual. So I like the romanticism you get in the Divine Comedy. I like the romanticism you get in those characters. I have no problem dealing with that on that level either.
Well, when you're talking about love rejections, I don't think anyone in the Star Trek universe has had more than poor Harry Kim.
yeah, both twins, right?
Indeed. Indeed. Well, are there any other examples that you thought of from the Star Trek universe that parallel to some degree or another Dante's Inferno and the Divine Comedy?
Yeah, I think the last honorable mention that I have is Dr. Crusher, who I think doesn't. There's very little, we get very little experience with Dr. Crusher in this regard. You know, she's in a bit of a dark place after her husband, Jack Crusher, dies. And you know, her relationship to Captain Picard has helped drag her out of that. You know, in the episode Sub Rosa, you know, we see Dr. Crusher kind of, you know, going off the path she's supposed to be on in a pretty radical way, right? She's willing to resign her commission and stay on this planet. And everyone around her recognizes something is wrong, right? And she's, you know, going off that path anyway. And of course, by the end of the episode, she's back and everything's fine. But, you know, it doesn't really mirror the Divine Comedy in any meaningful way. But there are plenty of characters, you know, these minor incidents where generally the character doesn't have any major problems. But once in a while, they fall off the rails. By the end of the episode, there's the magic reset button, and the character's, you know, back in fine condition because they're, you know, his or her friends pulled them out of it in that episode. And I think Dr. Crusher just kind of falls in that category. And this is really a blip for Dr. Crusher. This is not Dr. Crusher's normal state of affairs. Unlike, I think, for Worf. Worf has a deep-seated character issue, and Wesley has a deep-seated character issue. And I just don't see that in Dr. Crusher. This is really, really an aberration for Dr. Crusher to be willing to resign her commission and stay on this planet.
Oh, she's completely off the rails.
And because of that, everyone knows something's wrong because it's just so out of character. Whereas I think for a lot of these other characters we've talked about, there is something dark to their character that has given them, you know, I guess that they're more comfortable being in the dark. And they, right? And Wesley Crusher lives there a lot, and Worf lives there a lot, and Tom Paris lives in the dark a lot until they go on their journey. But that's not Dr. Crusher, I think. I think Dr. Crusher doesn't start out in a dark place despite the bad things that have happened to her.
So she doesn't exist there.
She doesn't exist there, unlike Captain Sisko, who does exist there.
Well, it just occurs to me that as we've cited all these examples, that it's never one character or another who assumes these roles, at least as it pertains to the Virgil and Beatrice characters. It's oftentimes all of them working together and moving from one role to another. As we mentioned with Captain Picard, sometimes he's both the Virgil and the Beatrice character to some degree in the episode. And I guess, you know, they say it takes a village. When we're talking about poor Wesley Crusher, it takes a village to raise that boy on Enterprise. I guess in this case, it takes a starship to raise him. But it occurs to me that these characters, it's why I appreciate them so much, because they can represent both the logic and human reasoning. They can represent divine love, and it really takes these two things together. And I think that's really the underlying theme, even from the original series. I mean, we had, again, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and Spock was often the voice of logic, and McCoy was the emotion, the camaraderie that they had with Kirk, and that's why he leaned on them so much, because they represented those two things, and that's true in life as well. So in that regard, you know, Dante's Inferno, again, is just the perfect metaphor for, I think, the human condition.
I think we circled back to talking about the trifecta of Captain Kirk and McCoy and Spock. I think we can draw out the metaphor just a little bit more. You know, Spock has his demons too, right? Spock can definitely go to the dark side, right? He's willing to, you know, first of all, he's willing to walk away from everything to pursue the discipline of Kolinar, pure logic, right? He can't do that, and that leads him to a dark side that leads him all the way back to the Enterprise. And at that point, it's his friends on the Enterprise that help get him out of that deep blue funk that you kind of see him in Star Trek the Motion Picture, right? He needs someone, his friends, to rally around him and appreciate him. And there's something symbolic, all of his friends rushing to Spock when he's first back on the Enterprise, and Spock can't really appreciate that. And there's I think this parallels really well to what you see in the Divine Comedy, because in the Divine Comedy, I think it's no accident that Virgil, the symbol of human reason or the symbol of human logic, is not in a light place. Virgil is resigned to forever living in limbo, right? Human reason can't get you all the way to enlightenment. It's very much counter to what you see in the history of modern philosophy. In the history of modern philosophy, starting all the way with the Copernican Revolution, all the way up to Descartes, the father of the modern philosophy, right up to the rest of the modern philosophers like Kant. Kant! And Hume and whatnot. All of them rely on light as a metaphor for human reason, right? It's called the Enlightenment for a reason. It's reason that illuminates the human condition in the modern worldview. And Dante is a pre-Enlightenment view, right? And he's basically saying human reason is resigned to a lower level. You know, human reason can is it forever resigned to limbo and at most purgatory for Dante. In fact, it's interesting because all the great philosophers in the Divine Comedy are in the first circle of hell. You get, you know, Aristotle, and you get Plato, and you get, you know, the rest. They're all in the first circle of hell, and there's this city that is it's an achievement. There's a city even in hell, right? And there's this faint glow that comes from it. It's a little dim light as contrasted with the light of divine love symbolized by Beatrice and, of course, God in Dante's view. And this is very much counter to what you get in modern philosophy. Modern philosophy tends to prioritize reason reason and make it the priority. And that goes all the way back from back to Plato and into the modern philosophers. But these are just kind of two contrasting worldviews. What is the role of reason, and is reason the path that leads to the greatest condition for mankind, or is it something else? And that duality is symbolized by Spock and McCoy, like we pointed out. But in Dante's view, human reason is not what gets you to paradise. And I think you can say something very similar about what we see in the characters in Star Trek. Spock, for all of his virtues, is never going to experience the pure humanity that we see symbolized by Dr. McCoy. Mm-hmm. And Spock has his dark side, despite all of his logical reasoning, despite his Vulcanness, Spock has a dark side, and Spock is needs the friendship and the camaraderie symbolized by everyone else on the Enterprise. Like I said, it takes a village, or it takes a starship. And I think that says something interesting about the role of reason as contrasted to how philosophers tend to think of the role of reason for the human condition.
So you concur with my conclusion that it takes a starship?
I do concur with that. Definitely in Star Trek, it takes a starship. And in most of these situations, it's not just one person who makes the difference. It's the entire crew who ultimately are all friends and all care about each other, and there's camaraderie, and they all help each other. And even though we can sort of identify some characters as being more Virgil-like or being more Beatrice-like, as we're talking about it here in Divine Comedy speak, really it's the entire crew as a family that always look out for each other no matter what comes. And that says something about the nature of the characters in Star Trek. And in my mind, that's more Beatrice-like than Virgil-like.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Dante's Inferno and how it relates to the Star Trek universe. But this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
The DNA of Star Trek fandom. And I've said it before, fandom existed, fandom enjoyed the show, but the main charge of fandom was to get the damn thing back.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield into saying they were using that same technology back then.
Literary Treks.
We have a long tradition here on Literary Treks of taking things seriously and having a good time while doing that. Tonight, well, we were going to take it seriously, but then the comics wouldn't let us.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where, I was talking to a guy, the new movie's coming out, obviously, and I'm like, have you seen the first one? And he's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, okay, well, let me bring it to you so you can take a look. And he watched it, and he came back the next day, and he's like, oh, yeah, that movie was really good.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no worries. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not trying to escape the inferno, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not hanging out in a dark wood all alone, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, I am most active on Facebook. You certainly can find me around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment, Zachary, to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from the network. Specifically, we would like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, who works so hard every day to bring this great content to our listeners.
And he leads all of us out of our dark wood.
Indeed he does. Executive producer Charlin Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director Aaron Harvey, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. I'd also like to give a shout out to our associate producers, Zachary. They are Patrick Devlin. You can contact Patrick on Twitter. His handle is at MagicDrop5. And Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can find her also on Twitter at ChocoWeeble is her handle. We want to thank both of you for your support of MetaTrex and Trek FM, the network. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.